Okay, we'll get started. It's 9:30. Boker Tov, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. Okay, so we're up to the third chapter in Pirkei Avot, Akavya ben Mahalel, one of my favorite, you know, people in the Mishnah. Well, I'll explain why in a moment. So chapter 3 is the end of the sort of chronological study of Pirkei Avot. We've mentioned already, the first chapter, of course, begins, Moshe got the Torah from Sinai, gave it to Yeshua, to Zgenim, the prophets, Anshei Knesset Gola, etc., all the way down to the son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnah. So we go through the first Mishnah, the period of Tanakh. Anshei Knesset HaGdolah is the beginning of the Second Temple period, the ones who established our tefillot, the ones who established that we make Kiddush on Friday night, etc. And then we go through, we mention the five generations of the two leaders, ending with Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai died approximately 100 years before the destruction of the temple, around the year zero, let's say. And they are the transitional generation to the Tanaim, the authors of the Mishnah. And then we continue, the Mishnah is really six generations or so, you know, but in the family of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi edits the Mishnah. He dies around the year 220 of the Common Era, and the Mishnah continues as his son. And then we go back. That was the whole first chapter, Pirkei Avot, going through the teachings of these sages, you know, so to speak. And then we went back in towards the beginning of the second chapter to Hillel again. Hillel being a key figure, and his student, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We first went to the scene, like father, son, father, son, father, son, to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And then we went through Hillel to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was, the Talmud says, the weakest of his students. We discussed if Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is your weakest student, boy, do you have an amazing class. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but the point what we have mentioned is that the brightest is not the best leader. I mean, in other words, when you're looking for who are the greatest rabbis today, the greatest halachic disciples, they're not necessarily the people who know the most. Obviously, you have to know a lot, but knowing the most that's not a criteria. It's many other factors, understanding how society works, understanding people, psychology, history, you know, how to use sources, how to analyze. So there are many, many things that go in just pure knowledge. But anyways, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was considered, the Talmud says, the weakest of his students, but he's the leader. And then we discussed, that's we ended last week, his five meek key students. We threw in Rabbi Tarfon at the end, as we discussed, because he discussed reward and punishment. Now, in the third chapter, we go back to the temple period, and we're going to discuss Akavya ben Mahalal. So Akavya ben Mahalal, I don't know what people know about him. He's mentioned very rarely. First of all, I love his name, Akavya ben Mahalal. It's a Mahalalel. To praise God, Mahalalel, I guess, to pronounce it. He's mentioned maybe, I think, four times in the Mishnah. And the most famous time, which we'll discuss now, which is why I really love him, is because of the Mishnah in Masechet Eidiot. So we'll get to, so just Akavya ben Mahalal was living in the temple period while the temple was standing, as is clear from the discussion we're about to have. And the Talmud says that Akavya, this is a Mishnah Eidiot. I don't know if I've ever mentioned. Has anybody ever learned Mishnah Eidiot? You can raise your hand or put it in the chat box. I imagine not too many people have learned Masechet Eidiot. So Masechet Eidiot, testimony, Eidut, testimonies. So Masechet Eidiot was the first Mishnayot ever written. The Tosefta, which is sort of a parallel collection of Tanaitic like teachings at the same time of the Mishnah, but were not included in the Mishnah, basically explains that when the rabbis came to Keren B'Yavneh, sort of after the time of Yochanan ben Zakkai, the temple is destroyed, they sat there and they said, okay, you know what? We're in danger of losing Judaism, of forgetting all our teachings, we better write it down. And the process of writing the Mishnah began soon after the destruction of the temple. It took over 100 years until it was finally edited. But, you know, it was a lot of, it wasn't Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi woke up and said, let's write the Mishnah, he did it. It was years and years of things going on beforehand that he had done. So the Mishnah says Tosefta says the rabbi sat down and they began with Hillel and Shammai. They began with the teaching of Hillel and Shammai, which is how Masechet Eidiot begins. It quotes the three arguments between Hillel and Shammai. You know, everybody knows Hillel and Shammai are always arguing. That's not true. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are always arguing. Hillel and Shammai almost never argue. There are three debates recorded, three, some say five, but in the Mishnah, there are three debates recorded between Hillel and Shammai. There are, I believe, about 330, I don't remember the exact number, debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, their students. And the Talmud says, because the students, we discussed this many weeks ago a little bit, the students, you know, they didn't pay attention so well, you know, and they didn't have tape recorders. Even if they did, it was not the same thing, you know. So this one, he said this, he said that. They're not 100% sure. So it was a lot of debate developed, and the Gemara is actually critical of that, at least in one area. So anyways, Hillel and Shammai. So Masechet Ediot is the most fascinating and diverse Masechet in the Talmud, but it's, I don't know, no one ever learns it. There's no Gemara on the Masechet, and so it's not in Daf Yomi. If you learn Daf Yomi, you won't get to Ediot, the funny part of Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi doesn't cover about half of the Mishnah, more than half. There are about 4,200 Mishnayot in our six orders of the Mishnah, and probably Talmud, Seder Taharot is by far the largest, has over 1,000. And only Masechet Nida, which I don't know, 70, 80 Mishnayot, has any Talmud. So right there, you got 900 Mishnayot without any Talmud. Zeraim only has, only Brachot has Talmud, so that's about 50 or 60 Mishnayot out of 500 or so, and then not everything everywhere else has Talmud. So like probably half the Mishnayos have no Talmud on them, no Gemara on them. And, you know, when you study Daf Yomi, you sort of ignore that. The Daf Yomi only goes to the Gemara. Whatever, that's how the system was set up. Maybe someday they'll change it. So when you go through that, they'll add an extra half a year, and it'll take 8 years maybe, and then you'll cover the Mishnayot that you don't cover when you learn Gemara. So Ediot doesn't have any Gemara on it. But what it is, it's a collection of testimonies of rabbis' teachings. Remember, this is the first teaching they're sort of recording. So it's has no one theme. It's got 500 themes. Like every Mishnah Kimat almost is a different theme, which is why it's so fascinating, because if you learn it, you get exposed to so many different areas. Many of these Mishnayot are then picked up again in their place where they appear. There was some in Ediot and somewhere else. Anyway, that's a little bit of background to Masechet Ediot, the tractate that are the testimonies of sages saying, I heard from this rabbi this, and I heard this, and we heard that. By the way, it's the end of Ediot where it talks on the Mashiach. That's really one of the only places in the Talmud where it talks that they have a tradition that what Eliyahu Hanavi is only coming to bring peace between parents and children. Right, this whole thing. What's Eliyahu going to do? Is he going to say this Jew is not really Jewish? We thought he's Jewish, he isn't. So that was one opinion. They say no, Eliyahu Hanavi is only coming. That's how Masechet Ediot ends. That's really a beautiful thing. But if you think of it as sort of, they didn't know, probably when they were writing Ediot, they didn't know what else was going to be included. So this was like, this had to be a complete unit. So it begins with Hillel and Shammai, their teaching, and it ends looking for the future. Remember, this is a generation after the destruction of the temple. They probably thought, like Rabbi Akiva for sure thought, that within 70 years, we'll build another temple. After the first temple, we built the second one. After the second one, we'll build a third one. No one envisioned that would be 1900 years later, 2000 years later, there wouldn't be a temple. That they couldn't perceive it. But okay, we never know the future. So it's interesting. So the Mishnah begins with Hillel and Shammai and ends with Eliyahu Hanavi, but you don't have any other teachings. This is where it's found. Anyways, a lot of beautiful Mishnayot here. So one of my favorite Mishnayot, if I can say that, in the entire corpus of the Mishnah is this Mishnah of Akavya ben Mahalalel. I like it, as you'll see, because of the intellectual honesty. So the Talmud says this is chapter 5, Mishnah 6 in Masechet Ediot. I'm sorry if I didn't share screen, whatever, you'll listen to my oral presentation. Akavya ben Mahalalel omer, he'id arba dvarim. So Akavya ben Mahalalel gave four, that's how that was he'id, the word he'id. He gave testimony on four things. Now the Mishnah then says, they interrupt, they say, Amrulo, Akavya. Akavya, it's very interesting. Akavya and Akiva are related. I don't know, like the names. And it's very interesting. The rabbis very often call Akiva, Akiva. They don't call him Rabbi Akiva. They call him Akiva. I don't know if that's because until 40, he was sort of like he had a different perception. You know, he wasn't really part of the group. You know, he was a later day addition, and then he surpassed them all. you know. And so I don't know, there's always this reference of, you don't call Rabbi Tarfon Tarfon, or you don't call Rabbi, you know, you don't call Rabbi Yoshua Yoshua, or Rabbi Eliezer Eliezer. They call them all, but somehow with Rabbi Akiva, Akiva, like the story in Makot when the fox is and Rabbi Akiva is laughing, say, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva, you have comforted us. Anyway, so the same thing here. I don't know if it's related, but Akavya, same letters, of course. Chazar bo barba dvarim sheitomer. You know what? You say four things. You have four opinions. So here's he saying his opinions. I tell you what, we don't like your opinions. You know, they're not in agreement with the majority of the sages. So if you recant on these four things, we nasecha av beit Yisrael, we'll appoint you the chief justice of the Supreme Court. You'll be the head of the Sanhedrin. We'll make you the av beit din. So they told the Kaviv, we can't have the leader of the Supreme Court somebody who disagrees with all the sages. You know, you got to sort of go with the flow. And so return and the there and so he said to them, Mutav li, it's better for me, lika reshota kol yamai. I don't mean being called a fool my entire life, but not to be wicked for 1 hour before God. In other words, so he's saying an amazing thing. That if, why would he change his opinion? He would change his opinion for two reasons. But one, to become the Nasi, but B, he would be saying something he doesn't believe in. He would be changing his opinion. Just, you know, he doesn't want to argue. He wouldn't be honest, and that's evil. You're not allowed to press your opinion. We spoke, I think, last week. We mentioned that you're the. I don't know when we mentioned this. We read in Parsha Dvarim a few weeks ago. Lo tagur mifnei ish. You're not allowed to be afraid. A member of the court is not allowed to be afraid of the rich. He's not allowed to be afraid of the powerful. Not afraid. Of, you got to say what you think. You can't. Otherwise, the perversion of justice is the breakdown of society. And lo tagur mifnei ish means rabbis. That's what the Lithuanian tradition is. You're not allowed to be afraid of the Rambam or Rashi. If you think Rashi's wrong, of course you have to with humility and the, who am I to think right? But we ask questions on Rashi, me and you, we can ask questions. The idea that, oh my God, how can we argue on this? That's not at all a Jewish idea. The idea is that, that's not lo tagur mifnei ish. Rashi was in the ish and Moshe Rabbeinu was in the ish and everybody. So you're not allowed to be afraid. That's the famous comment I mentioned, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the founder of the great yeshiva in Volozhin, the Harvard of all yeshivot, the mother of all yeshivot, said that if a rabbi is convinced, doesn't mean me, it means a great rabbi is convinced that the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, and he says, I'm going to follow the Shulchan Aruch anyways, he's not allowed to. That means he's afraid of Rav Yosef Karo. You're not allowed to be afraid of Rav Yosef Karo. You have to take Rav Yosef Karo very seriously. But that was the Lithuanian tradition that we don't honor anybody. So that would be considered evil if he would change his opinion, not because he believes it, but to get appointed. That was A. Shelo Yomrim, then what are people going to say? Bishvil Shrora Chazarpo, that he, why did he change his opinion? To get appointed. Like in other words, he was a politician. What does a politician do? They look at the polls. Oh, I believe this. I believe that. You know, that's what Rav Soloveitchik's famous line that I love to quote, that politics is kulo sheker. This is exactly based on this Mishnah. Politics is complete lying. People lie to you. We know it's that's why politics and religion don't mix. That's why in the Torah, the religious leaders are not allowed to be involved in politics. Halavai that Israel should learn from this, that the Kohanim and the and Shevet Yehuda, the Malchut, the monarchy, and the religious leadership are totally separate. And the Ramban is very critical of the Chashmonim. You're not allowed to relate religion and politics because politics is dirty. It's the nature of politics. It's you got to roll in the mud and you got to make compromise and you got to this and this and you say things you don't believe in because it scores points. That's how that system. Okay, maybe it's bad, but it ain't going to change. So, but to put religion into that system is terrible. It destroys the religion. So that's what that somebody would say. I became the religious leader. I changed my opinion to be religious. That's a terrible thing. That's what a politician does. That's what, but that's not what a religious leader can do. So he gave up being the religious leader because he wouldn't change his opinion on four areas of law. Now, what's crazy about this is these are the most obscure areas of Jewish law. And by the way, he was lenient on at least two and a half of them. And so he wasn't even that he was strict. he was strict on a couple of them. Like, it's one thing, Rabbi, oh, you have to be strict. No, he was strict. They told him you have to be lenient. Or both. He was both. And he refused. So that's why I love a Kavi ben Mahalal, person of intellectual honesty. You have to do what you have to believe. And the cost you the Supreme Court nomination, too bad. You don't want to be a member of the Supreme Court. I don't want a Supreme Court where the people, play politics. Okay, it's whatever. That's why we need Eliyahu Hanavi. That's why when the Imad HaMashiach will have that. Okay, we don't have that in our world. What can you do? But I do want to focus on another aspect that Kavya ben Mahalal said, and that is, so one of the things he argued with was, the other words was the laws of purity had to do with tzarat. What we mistranslate as leprosy. So the white hair and the skin is a person's tzarat or not. So he had some argument on there, what is considered tzarat. He had an argument, this one maybe was a little more practical, on the blood. When a woman menstruates and the coloration of the blood isn't red, at what point is the blood considered pure or impure? Okay, that's an important argument. An argument there. And then he had an argument about a firstborn animal, the hair fell off, whatever. I'm not going to get into all the technical details, but we know a firstborn animal is dedicated to the Kohen unless it develops a defect in which which it can be eaten. And there was fear people would keep the animal until there's a defect so they wouldn't have to, sacrifice it, whatever. So they had an argument there. And then the fourth argument was about whether a convert who is accused by her husband of being an adulteress. So that's not a great, not a fun case. But we know one of the strangest laws of the Torah is the Parsha of Esota, where a man, for good reason, it's not that he just accuses her. The woman is being basically flirting with some guy who's not her husband. And the husband has to warn her in advance, don't be alone with this person, I don't like it, in front of two witnesses. And then she's caught alone with this person. We don't know if anything happened. So that woman becomes a sota. If she says she committed adultery, or even if she just says, fine, the husband divorces her, that's the end of the story. The court doesn't punish her, nothing happens. They get divorced and they move on. If not, she claims she's innocent, so the husband takes her to the temple, and they feed her, they erase the Torah that was spoken last night in the shir, Rabbi Gelman's shir, not to erase God's name, is in this week's like Parsha. So the Torah, that's a verse we're going to read tomorrow, but the Torah allows you to erase God's name for the sota, because as the Talmud says, to promote peace between husband and wife, we even erase God's name. The importance of peace, Baruch Hashem, Israel and the UAE, whatever, but all peace is so important, we can even erase God's name for the promotion of peace. So there was a question whether a convert is included in these laws. Why are they even converts? The 99.9% is the same, but there are a couple laws that are different with a convert. So that was a discussion. So he said, no, Akavi ben Mahalal said, cannot. The rabbi said, yes, converts no different than anybody else. So they brought a proof. They told her that Shemaiah and Avtalion, they were the generation, the leadership before Hillel and Shammai. So they said that Shemaiah and Avtalion did make a convert drink of these water. Okay, who cares? Some obscure argument that happened 2,000 years ago when there's some woman who was convicted of adultery, was a convert, had to drink these waters. So the Mishnah says, so that was said, it must be. Shemaiah and Avtalion did it. That's going to be our tradition and we're going to do it. So they say that Akavya ben Mahalal made a comment, which is very fat, like hard to, when I said, he said, Dugma Hishkua. Dugma Hishkua says, what do you mean? He means they were biased. See, Shemaiah and Avtalion, according to the Rambam, were converts. At least the seven converts were converts. You know why they did it? Because they didn't want to discriminate against the convert. They were extra sensitive. The Torah says we should be extra sensitive to the convert. But here there was a distinction in the law, or so he claimed. But Shemaiah and Avtalion didn't follow the same because they were converts themselves. So he basically accused them of being showing favoritism to converts. So the Mishnah says they put a Kavya ben Mahalal into Cherem. They excommunicated him. To claim that a rabbi would state, remember, that's how the Mishnah began. A Kavya ben Mahalal has got to be like totally intellectually honest. The claim that a rabbi would changes view for political considerations or some kind of, because he was biased towards that, that is worthy of being excommunicated. So that's a fascinating, idea. And it's very important. You have to, you have to be intellectually honest. Listen, every human being is biased. It's impossible not to be biased. The rabbis go to great lengths, try to eliminate biases, conflict of interest, and who can be a judge, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what they said, that comment they excommunicated. But what comes next is even more fascinating. Rabbi Yehuda says, impossible. It is impossible that Akavya ben Mahalalel got excommunicated. You know why? Chas v'shalom, she'akavya nitnada. God forbid. The courtyard of the temple never closes. When the courtyard of the temple closes, this is a reference to Erev Pesach. An Erev Pesach is the most crowded day in the temple because every Jew has to bring a Paschal lamb. Okay, not every single person has to bring it, but every person has to eat from a Paschal lamb. So a lamb could feed 50 people. Okay, whatever. So or how many people are going to have at your Seder? How many people are going to at your Seder? They have, remember, can't have any leftovers. So there are hundreds of thousands of lambs being brought on Erev Pesach. So the Mishnah describes the pageantry and how quickly they had to slaughter hundreds of thousands of animals in one day. So they had to do it in shifts. They couldn't do it in shifts. So they would wait till the temple courtyard was full. They would close the gates, okay, and that's they sing Hallel as they did it. They'd be singing, etc. And when they closed the gates, the most pious person there was Akavya ben Mahalalel. He was the greatest in chokhmah, in wisdom and yirat chet, both in wisdom and in fear of God. So you must have now. It's fascinating. The Mishnah doesn't say he didn't say it. Right? That's not what it's saying. And now it could be that's what he means. Maybe your story's wrong. He couldn't have said it. That's not exactly what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says they didn't put him to cherem. Maybe he did say it. A slip of the tongue. Maybe it's a little true even. Even great people, that's the, you don't put someone excommunicated because they made one slip of the tongue once. So it's actually fascinating to respond. Impossible, because he was the most pious and wise person that came. Hello, who did they put into Nidui? Eliezer ben Chanoch, some other rabbi who we never heard of. Eliezer ben Chanoch, that he said you don't have to do Nitilat Yadayim. You don't have to wash your hands before you wash. Okay, I just think it's a fascinating story within the Mishnah that I talked about. Akavya ben Mahalalel not saying, I don't care if I'm called the fool my whole life. I answer to God and God alone. I don't care what people say. I have to answer to God. That's A and B. I don't want people saying, oh, I did it because I wanted to get power. Why do I hold my views? Because it's good in the polling. It's good to get elected. I've never understood, well, whatever. I won't go, but in the United States, they elect, it's one thing to elect the, by the way, elections are important, of course, but not to elect a judge. To elect a leader who leads you is very important. As a matter of fact, Rav Soloveitchik was, they have Rav Schechter quotes in Nefesh HaRav that Rabbi Soloveitchik felt if, unfortunately, very sad, often when shuls and rabbis don't see eye to eye, it can be a very painful process. You know, the rabbi doesn't want to leave. It's very unpleasant. And sometimes it's more pleasant. They agree, but often not. So Rav Soloveitchik said, if the shul doesn't want the rabbi, that's it. The rabbi doesn't have a right to the job. The rabbi's appointed to be the leaders of the community. If the community doesn't want him, that's it. Goodbye. It's, in other words, when you have a leader, it makes it easy. We are democratic, but our judicial system is not a democracy. Our judicial system is very impartial. It has to be totally unbiased so that you can't vote for a judge. You have to appoint judges who are very pious. But anyway, so that's what the Mishnah said. Now, it's the next Mishnah continues. It's even more fascinating. I think maybe you don't agree. You can tell me. When he was on his deathbed, he said to his children, sons, I held my four positions. Even though all the sages argue with me, I held I was right, and I'm not going to change my opinion just because some rabbi says so. You know, if you're entitled to an opinion, you don't change your opinion just because somebody else, even if the majority says so. But he taught his children, you should follow, don't follow my opinion, follow the majority of the rabbis. So the student said, why? Isn't a son supposed to follow the traditions of the father? Well, why should we not follow what you say? So he says, listen, says, me, I learned this on my own. I studied this. This is the opinion. Apparently his sons were not such great scholars, as is often the case. As I mentioned last week, I think, or I don't know where he mentioned, the Torah says that the children of Torah scholars are generally not Torah scholars. That's done on purpose. So people shouldn't think that you inherit the Torah. There's like a Torah gene. And if you're born into the right family, you'll be a Torah scholar. No, no, no. We want people coming from nowhere, like Rabbi Akiva's, and people coming out of nothing to become great Torah scholars. And we see that from great families, they have children often who are a very pale reflection, at least in learning, sometimes in other ways too, of their parents. So this kid's also, so he said, listen, I discovered this on my own. This is my opinion. What I really, really believe. I'm not going to change my view just because others disagree. But you don't really know. You don't really have an opinion. You heard it from me and you're from the rabbi. Then you follow what the majority of the rabbis say. You don't just follow a minority opinion. It's also very important in Jewish law. You know, sometimes people, oh, there's one rabbi who said something. Who cares? There's one rabbi who said something. If you're that one rabbi, that's okay. But when you don't know much and you're asking, so 98% of rabbis say A and 2% say B. You can't follow 2% unless you follow this rabbi in everything that you're allowed to do. In other words, if you pick a rabbi and he's your rabbi for everything, so you can follow him in his minority majority, but that's not how most people work. Most people sort of follow a consensus, but you can't say in this area, he's lenient. In this area, he's lenient. You know, you pick and choose your rabbi. That's not Judaism. So that's what he's saying. His kids, 98, you know, in other words, you don't really know much, so you should follow the majority view, even though I'm your father and I felt differently. So that's a fascinating thing. That's what he told them on his deathbed. And then the children said to their father, you know, put in a good word for us. You can see already the kids weren't so great. So the son said to the father, put in a nice word, tell your sages we're good people. And the father said, no, I'm not going to do that. So the children said, is there anything wrong with us? Said, no. Just masecha yekarvucha, masecha yerachucha. Your actions will bring you closer and your actions will set you apart. In other words, anti-nepotism. This is the intellectually honest person. You know what, kids? If you do well, you do good, you'll make it. If not, you won't. I'm not going to get you a position, a good job, just because you're my son. Into nepotism, that'd be a terrible thing. It's a beautiful Mishnah, in my opinion. That's why I love Akavi ben Mahalal. You have his total intellectual honesty, not willing to change his view, even if it cost him a high position. He doesn't want people, because he understood it would sully the whole position. People will say, I did it. You know, we know when people talk, it cheapens it, the whole political system. People don't have respect for leaders when they don't trust their leaders. So he understood. First of all, it was his own intellectual honesty, and B, the social impact it would have. People would say, he just wants to get reelected. Well, you know, to put it in the modern term. And B, his idea is anti-nepotism. And C, even great people can make a mistake. And he made a slip of the tongue and he said, Shmaya ben Abtalion, we're sort of biased towards the convert. So that's a long, long introduction. I hope you don't mind. About Akavi Mahal, we'll get to what he said, but let me just answer. I think somebody sent me a private question. I'll answer it now because I usually forget. What about family tradition? No, that's not true. That's what I'm pointing. The family tradition appears, okay, if everything in normal circumstances, Ashkenazim do this, Sephardim do this, this community did that, etc. But if it's sort of, the whole world does once, and this rabbi has his own unique opinions, which you often have among great rabbis, that great rabbis have their own unique opinions. So the family tradition doesn't always count. Truth matter, that's the first Mishnah in the entire Talmud. Me'emetai kurim teshma ba'arbit. When do you read Shema at night? So the Mishnah quotes a three-way debate. You have to finish saying Shema basically 10 o'clock at night, midnight, or you have all night to say the Kriyat Shema. And Rabbi Gamliel said you have all night to say Shema. And his kids came home from a party in the first Mishnah. His kids came home from it said they were out at a Beit HaMishteh, out drinking, whether it was a wedding, whatever. And they came back, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. So they asked their father, can we still say Shema? So the father didn't say, well, of course you can say Shema. I hold you can say Shema all night. No, no. The father told the son, you have to follow the view of the sages. However, the sage is really allowed to say it all night. They just said it to say midnight to protect you in case you'll fall asleep first. But you see, Rabban Gamliel also instructed his own kids, don't follow his opinion. If Rabban Gamliel's kids had learned with Rabban Gamliel and studied and followed, then yes, they would follow the path of their father. But they're just regular people. So you don't take the quirks of your parents just because, you know, your parents did. It's true, in a community can follow a custom. That's what there was a private question about. Rav Yossi Haglili, in his town, they people want to move there, I think. In his town, they ate chicken and milk. So the Gemara praises this town. People, everybody who lived in this town ate chicken and milk because the prohibition Torah is only meat and milk. The rabbis were afraid with mixed meat and poultry. And the Rav Yossi Haglili wasn't afraid. So in his town, so you want to move to the Galil, you can eat chicken and milk. No, that's not really true, but I don't think that's true. Once the Gemara was established, that view didn't become acceptable. This is a fascinating topic. When are people allowed to hold their own views? When do you need a consensus? And when, basically, without a Sanhedrin, you can't enforce consensus. There's even a whole debate. Why is the Talmud authoritative? In other words, why can't we argue on the Talmud? So that's not such a simple answer. In other words, the assumption in traditional Orthodox Judaism, whatever you want to call it, whatever, is we can't argue on the Talmud. In other words, if the Talmud has an unequivocal ruling, often the Talmud itself is debate. So then you have a debate, which you to follow. But when the Talmud has an unequivocal ruling, we cannot disagree with the Talmud. That's the question is, why not? So that's not so thousand different opinions. Why not? It's for another time. But we assume today there is no rabbinic authority that can enforce their view on everybody. We don't have a Sanhedrin, and therefore everybody should follow their local rabbi and their community. Exactly. That's what we do. You have to asay l'charav. You have to pick a rabbi, you follow the consensus, and that's why we have different customs and different people do different things, and that's great. That's the way it should be. Okay, let's discuss what Akavya ben Mahalal said. Famous Mishnah, I think he's stuck up a shlosha dvarim. He's stuck up. It's more than look at. It's focus on three things. You won't come to sin. So we know already. We had this in the second chapter. Rebbe also said, look at three things. You won't come to sin. Know what's above you: a seeing eye, a hearing ear, and everything you do is written in a book. That was Rebbe's answer. Kavi ben Mahalal asks the same question, or the gives discussing the same issue. Look at three things, and you won't come to sin. Damei ayin bata, where you come from. Lana Tolach, where you're going to, before whom you're going to give an accounting. So if I just read this first half of the Mishnah, I would say, what's he saying? I have to look at three things. I have to know where I come from. You come from a wonderful family. You have to follow the traditions of your parents and your grandparents. You have to live up to the name of the family, right? We know that people are brought up that way. You know, you're part of the royal family. There's certain expectations. You're part of a rabbinic family, you're part of a business family. The father will train you. You know, he wants you to take over the business one day. There's this idea where you come from is very much going to tell you where you're going. But it's also, that's right. And where are you going? You have to have a path in life, right? If you don't know where you're going, any path will get you there. You have to know where you're coming from. What are your goals? And if you want to take it on a religious level, you have to sort of link, you know, we're coming from Mount Sinai, whatever. We come from a tradition, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, whatever. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And we have to pass it on to our children. That's where we're coming from, where we're going. But that's not how he answers the question. I mean, I'm not saying he would disagree with that. But that's his focus is not on the individual like person. In other words, it's not an individual question. Where are you coming from? Where are you going? That's an important idea. But it's a human question. In other words, he's not saying, he's talking to humanity. And it's not only Jews. If the way I understand it, not only Jews. Because may I invite, where do we come from? Etipas rucha. A smelly seed. That's where we all come from. We're all born from, I think it's Rashi. We say it's Elul. Elul is next Friday. Oh my gosh. We blow shofar beginning next Friday. I don't know what people are doing with shofar this year, but whatever. Then in theory, we start blowing shofar next Friday. And we say, L'David Hashem Ori V'Ishi. So we say, Ki Avi V'Imi Azavuni, right? Do we say to her, my parents have forsaken me, right? David HaMelech, he wants to dwell in the house of God. Shivita Achat Shuat Meir Hashem. My parents have forsaken me. So if I'm not mistaken, I have to look this up. Rashi says there, it's an unbelievable comment. But I do want to check to verify, but my parents, what do you mean? My parents created me, they weren't concerned about me. They were interested in their own pleasure. They were having fun. And I was the result of what happened. Ki aviva mi is when the Lord, I come from a tipas rucha. I come from a human being. Like you're a biological accident. So, you know, so to speak. And where are we going? L'makom afa rima v'toleya. We're going to end up in the earth, you know, with the ants and the maggots are going to eat us up. It's a very depressing, like mission. We have to address that. We come from nothing. We're going to, it says in Torah, we may afar, we come from the ground, then we'll go to the ground, right, ever. And who are we going to have to give an accounting for? Okay, so if we're coming from nothing, we're nobodies. So, okay, so have a fun life. Then they'll put you in the ground when time's over. Okay, good. Yeah, you enjoyed life. Doesn't work that way. Because you're going to have to have an accounting. The Melech, Malche, Hamlachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, even the whole name. Melech, Malche, the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. You have to give an accounting to Him. So I would say that it's a depressing Mishnah, no? What, I should walk around thinking, you know, we're going to end up in the grave. That's not the way to live. We don't want to live like that. We don't believe in thinking about death all the time. That's the Gemara says one of the great gifts God gave us is we forget. That's a great gift. It would be a horrific life if you remembered everything. And it's not just, of course, we all like to have a good memory, but it's the experiential memory. In other words, to relive a moment, right? If you the excitement, you know, of a wedding is not the same. You know, 6 months later, it's not the same. But God forbid, if you could remember the emotion of a moment 5 years later, then you couldn't live. A person dies, you couldn't move on, right? There, we have the Shiva, the Shloshim, the Yud Beit Chodesh. We don't want to remember everything. We don't want to talk about that. The Gemara says, Hamek Mishtacheach Min Alev. The dead is forgotten from the heart after 12 months. That doesn't mean it literally, obviously, but it means after 12 months, we expect a person to get back to a normal existence. In other words, all forms of mourning end after 12 months. You're not allowed to mourn more. So what's this mission of Avakavya? It's true. So maybe saying, okay, every once in a while, you know, before Rosh Hashanah, before Elul, it's a good mission to learn. But I don't know that it's good for every day. So I would think it's right. I assume he's talking about only when a person's about to sin. If a person, in other words, we don't think about this too often, but every once in a while, we have to put this in our mind. The Gemara says that if pagaba menuvelzeh, this menuvel, the menuvel, the disgusting thing, the Yetzer Hara, in other words, you have a burning desire to sin. So the Gemara says you do three things. He says, and now I forget the first two, which the order. I think first you say Kriyat Shema. No, it says Mashcheh Lebeit Ham, you know, you bring him into the base medrash. You know, you have it's a beautiful idea. You want to sin, you know what to do? Open up a book and learn. You'll get into the excitement of learning the intellectual theory. You'll learn how to debate the Bayin Rabbah. You'll learn Pirkei Avot. You'll learn Chumash. You'll learn Gemara. You'll forget about your desire to sin. Mashcheh lebein medrash. Bring the Yetzer Hara to the base of medrash. He might enjoy the learning too. If not, say Kriyat Shema. Say, accepting, if that doesn't work. And then the Gemara says the third step doesn't work. Think of Yom HaMita. Think you're going to die. Well, we don't think we're going to die first. In other words, that's not good. That's only if the base medrash doesn't work. And if the Kriyat Shema doesn't work, then you have to die. So this, I think this mission is really only talking like we shouldn't walk around life, you know, to think, because it says, look at these two things and you won't sin. So it's clear the mission is talking about when you're about to sin. So when you're about to sin, that's a good time to think that you're going to end up in the grave. But normally you shouldn't think like that. That's not normal. That's not healthy. I'll just say two extra ideas on the Mishnah. The Tiferet Yisrael, 19th century, we quote him all the time, says the three, he does a lot of this stuff, you know, other Mishnah has like three rules, five rules, different things. So he says, there are three basic reasons. I'm sure everybody can think of other reasons. Three basic reasons why we sin. Number one, arrogance. That's arrogance is the one thing God really, really, really doesn't like. One other their custom that also is very rarely done. This was not done where the Rabbi Shul on Saturday night. I don't know how many of your shuls after Vayhi Noam, before Aleinu, usually they say it. It's actually very beautiful, but it's pretty long. Can take a good at least 5 minutes to say it properly. We quote all these verses as we're about to go back to the world. So there we quote the Gemara and Megillah about the Anivus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, wherever you find the greatness of God. As a matter of fact, it was last week's Parsha. Where we find the greatness of God, we find this humility. It says God is great. Last week's Parsha, then he feeds the orphan, the widow.
We're going back 15 minutes.
You mute yourself. I didn't mute everybody, but okay. So so arrogance, the Gemara says, when somebody's arrogant, God says, I can't live here with him. He's too great. So we know, of course, arrogance is a main driver of sin. Number two is lust and desire. That's not the same as arrogance. Yeah, people have lust for all kinds of things. That's normal. We just have to learn how to channel it properly. And number three is ideological reasons. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in Torah. I don't believe in this stuff. So obviously, you're not going to follow what it says. So he says that's what the three things of the Mishnah. The arrogance is, you say you're arrogant. You're a nobody. You were born by accident. You're a biological fluke. The ants were born before you. Don't be so arrogant. Right. That's Rav Soloveitchik explains the problem with evolution. Rav Soloveitchik in the book they published after he died, the whole series of book, what's called Ethics. I forget the exact name. But, you know, after the Rav passed away, they published, I think there now are 10 volumes on a lot of writings the Rav had written that hadn't published. And they put them together. They weren't so easy into different themes. So one was about ethics. And the Rav said there, he has no problem with the science of evolution. That's the greatness of God. God plugged the button and, you know, and the whole process began. He doesn't have a problem scientifically. He says the problem with evolution is a moral problem. In other words, if you believe that we're no morally different from them, we're just an extension of an ape or a monkey or an ant or an amoeba, whatever, and therefore we're not morally responsible. That's the problem with evolution. So when we tell a person you're where you come from, that's a moral responsibility. It's not a scientific question. But a person who's arrogant, we can tell them the evolution story. You're just a fluke of nature. So don't be so arrogant. Number two, lust and desire. That'll kill you. That'll lend you to the grave. You know, the seeking, you drink, you'll destroy your liver, whatever, you know, all kinds of things. But we know lust can kill. And number three, ideological. If you really don't believe it's not going to help. But you tell somebody, you know what? Everything you do, God is going to watch. You're going to have to give an accounting. I once heard, I think it was the name of the Vilna Gaon. I thought it's a powerful idea. You have to give a din and cheshbon. You know, who are a judgment and an accounting? Okay, yeah, so what's the difference between a deen and a cheshbon? Rosh Hashanah is a yom adin, the day of judgment. What's a cheshbon is an accounting. So you do an accounting to give a judgment. Okay, but I think it was the Vilna Gaon said the deen is you're going to have to explain to God what you did wrong. You're going to have to be punished for what you did wrong. Number two, you're going to have to explain or get punished for what you could have done right while you were doing something wrong. In other words, it's bad enough you wasted your time doing narishkeit or gossiping, just sitting there and schmoozing and gossiping. Not only did you gossip, is you didn't learn. You didn't learn masechet ediyot, whatever. You didn't learn whatever you had to learn. So it's a double whammy. But anyways, a kavim mahalapet, you see, it fits in to the Mishnah. We learned in ediyot. The Mishnah says there was no one in Israel who had greater fear of sin than a kavim b'mahalo. So somebody like that, you would expect him to say, you know, think about where we come from. Born, it's not normal. People don't really think like this. You know, we come from nothing and we're going to end up in the grave. It's a depressing thought. And it's not something to normally think about, but it's an important thought to think about. Okay, next, Mishnah Beit. We're also in the Beit HaMikdash. Rabbi Hanina Yaskana Kohenim, the assistant Kohen Gadol. You know, the Kohen Gadol had a backup, had an assistant, before Yom Kippur, in case, he couldn't function at the lot, like on Broadway. You know, you have to have every play, you have to, the guy get sick the day before, you know, the play must go on, the show must go on. So you have to have a backup actor. So you have to have can you imagine if the Kohen Gadol can't function on Yom Kippur. So you need a backup Kohen Gadol. So that's the first Mishnah in Yuma. The week before they would pick the Kohen Gadol, the backup, there's a fascinating argument in the Mishnah. Does he need, it's like unbelievable. For us people, it sounds so weird. But maybe it was weird then too, but not as weird. But I don't think. They have a debate. Could he have a backup wife? Did you have to say, why do you need a backup wife? Because one of the laws is the Kohen Gadol has to be married. That's the Jewish way. You have to be married, ideally. Okay, a lot of people are married, fine, but okay, it's also, we have to deal with them. We have to be understanding. But we have a huge singles problem today. But the Kohen Gadol had to be married. So the Mishnah said, what if his wife dropped dead the week before Yom Kippur? So the one opinion is you have to prepare a wife. The Mishnah, we accept, no. We have to prepare a second Kohen Gadol because it's not just if he dies. There are many things that become impure, but we don't prepare a second wife. And I imagine part of it is this idea. It's not so nice to wife number one to say that here's wife number two, even though in theory, you could marry more than one wife in biblical time. You know, it was extremely rare. It was not commonly done at all. There's no Talmudic sage. I don't believe, not of the thousands of people mentioned Talmud, not one of them has ever mentioned of having two wives. The Talmud allowed it, and for probably perhaps historical reasons, it was important. Men would die, went to war. It was often to protect the woman. So there may have been a reason to allow polygamy at some point, but it was never common. It was never a good idea. So I don't think it would be so nice to tell the wife, oh, by the way, you know, here's your backup wife. Maybe you want to meet her, have a l'chaim. You know, I don't think that would go over so well. Anyway, so the Skana Kohanim, Rabbi Chanina Skana Kohen, have you meet Palo b'shloma shalmachut? So this is an important Mishnah, also a famous Mishnah. You have to pray for the welfare of the government, any government. She'il malei mora'a, ish et re'echaim b'lo. If you don't have fear of government, it means dictatorship. If you don't have fear of government, people will swallow each other alive. So I'm going to share my screen for one moment. I hope this works. And I'm sure maybe many of you have seen this already. Let me just find it here. Okay, so here we go. So this is taken from a siddur in the 19th century. It can read it. Hanotein shualim malachim imam shalal v'nesichim. That's the same language you use for the prayer for the state here, like in Canada and the United States. Machuto machu kol olamim. His kingdom is, all the world. Hapotzeh tavir avdo mechai ra'ah. Hanotein b'yam derech v'mayim azim netiva. You can see the translation at the bottom. Hu yivarech b'yishmor b'yinsor. He should bless and guard and protect and help and raise the v'yigdal. B'yinasi lemala et Adonenu, our master, HaKesar. Nikolai Alexandri, imishto HaKesarid, HaBechura Alexandri. I don't know how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce it? Fedorina. So you see in English, this is the prayer for the Tsar. That they used to say, based on this Mishnah, you have to pray for the welfare of the government. Now, you may want to argue that that's done okay for political reasons. You don't pray for the Tsar; they'll put you into jail. I don't know. I don't know if they had in every shul the Tsar had the KGB. I mean, you have to think of the Tsar. I mean, we're talking about where Jews were drafted to the army for 25 years. You know, the cantonist system, you know, a little bit of the history of 19th century Russia, what went on there and terrible things. And also Jews who were wealthy paid off people. It's a whole horrific story. The Tsar was not somebody we liked very much. You know, the famous line in Fiddler on the Roof, right? Keep the Tsar, pray for him, pray to be very, very far away from us. Nonetheless, you have to, we know that anarchy is worse than anything. And I would say that holds true today in China. I mean, these are evil countries. I would still say you prefer China with a strong government, and you don't want, we can think of all the countries that have fallen apart, but up into Lebanon for years. Now they sort of have a government, but you know, the civil war, therefore we can think of countries that fall apart that don't have strong leadership. So that's what the Mishnah says. You have to daven for the welfare of the government, because otherwise people eat each other alive, even if the government is not a good government. I don't get into the whole politics with, you know, Israel. I'm sorry? So you have the prayer for, and so that was the traditional prayer, Anotein Shual and Melachim, Umam Shalal and Nesichim. That's what we say today, I think. Now, it does bother me. Sometimes I go to Shul, and In many shuls, they only, and it depends where you daven, but in the many of the modern Orthodox shuls, I don't know many, in some of the Orthodox shuls, you can tell me, they only say the prayer for the government of Israel. I'm into a lot of shuls, you know, where they only say the prayer for the government of Israel. So I think that's very wrong. I don't, listen, it's very nice to say the prayer for the government of Israel, but if you live in Canada, there's no obligation to say the prayer for the government of Israel. Of course, we do it, and it's become very symbolic of your Zionism, whatever, but it's not, that's not the law. The law, in other words, unless you want to feel that Israel's our country, even when we don't live there, like you give tzedakah to people in Israel. Okay, whatever. But the halacha is, it is a halacha here. Having mipala b'shlom shemachud, you're supposed to say the, I mean, I don't know if that's the way you do it exactly, but that's the way we do it. You say the prayer for the government. So it's important to say the prayer for Canada or the United States, wherever you might live, regardless of what you think of the government. I remember when, you know, especially in Israel, where often, you know, people they protest a lot more. They protest here too, not whatever. So people say, "How can I pray for the government?" You know, they took the Jews out of here. They did this. They gave back settlements. Whatever your view is, that's when you have to pray for the government even more. In other words, when it's not a prayer for because you like the government. It's a prayer for keeping order and peace. Anyways, that's just an important thing that I think we all know, but it is important that the Beit Yisrael says, having mipalel b'shlomo shamachut, see, that's the thing. Tamid. That's very fun. Always. It's like you know, the Shemone Esrei, you say only three times a day. To pray for the welfare of government, that's like 24/7. I don't think it means it literally. Tamid, you always have to pray for the welfare. Now, I don't know anybody that prays every day. They only say it on Shabbos. Interesting. When I was in high school, if I'm not mistaken, right, so I went to the only Bnei Akiva high school in, I think it's still the only Bnei Akiva high school outside of Israel. Orchaim, it's called the Bnei Akiva High School. Religious, I mean, there are many religious Zionist schools, but it was like officially, you know, and all our teachers were all Israelis, all Shlichim, Kimat, and I believe, we used to say to Lel Shlomo Medina, I think they said it on Mondays and Thursdays. But that's very unusual. Thanks, man. Yeshiva. Takes, I don't think people would tolerate that in a regular shul. It would take too much time. You know, people are in a hurry in the morning. Anyways, but that's the halacha of imbel b'shlom shemachut. By the way, the prayer for the government of Israel is not really the time for it. It has a very different format. Avinu shebashmaim tzur Yisrael v'golo v'rechem medinat Yisrael, our Lord in heaven. And the true mother, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was very conservative, small c conservative in all these areas. He didn't add extra kina for tishma. He didn't like to add anything for our prayer service. He felt we can't do that, but it doesn't have a typical Jewish flavor. Like normal libraries are Yehi Ratzon Mefanecha, Shemokinu Avinu Shebashmaim. It's like our Lord in heaven. It's sort of a more, whatever, Christian, you know, there's a lot written who composed the prayer for the government of Israel. So it's generally assumed today that it was basically Lishai Agnon, that Rav Herzog, the first chief rabbi of Israel, may have had some input, but that's the, I think, the scholarly consensus today. Because it was never really, I think they sort of, you know, it was done. Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi in 1948. That Shai Agnon, the great author, wrote it and then, you know, became accepted. We know the English version. I remember Norman Lamb giving a talk about this, Rabbi Lamb at YU. You know, the controversial phrase, Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, is Israel the beginning of our redemption? That has nothing to do with the Tfilah L'Shlom HaMedina. You have to pray for the government. You live in Israel, you have to pray for the government. If you can be anti-government, you can be against the whatever, you have to pray for the government. That's a law. You're not allowed to not pray for government. You don't have to say Reshit Smichat Gulatenu. That's no law. And whether that is, that's a whole interesting controversy, unfortunately, that takes political overtones, which is a simple Mishnah. Okay, let's try to, it's getting late, I see. yeah, no, I'm not saying the rabbis were pro-Christian. I'm saying the term Avinu Shebashmaim has more, I think, there were some rabbis who raised that issue. But anyway, Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, Omer, Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, of course, was one of the Asara Harugi Malchut, the 10 martyrs killed by the Romans, the famous story. He's Rabbi Meir's father-in-law, the father of Bruria, one of the few women whose rulings in Jewish law are accepted in the Talmud. And she, that's the famous story. They wrapped him around in, with the, you know, we mentioned the famous story we read about Yom Kippur. They wrapped him around so he would die much slower with wet, you know, whatever, wet stuff around. his body, and they asked him, they said to him, why don't you breathe in the fire so you'll die earlier? And he said, no, I can't do that. Only God gives can take away life. And then they said, well, what if the Roman executioner raises the flame? And they said, that would be fine, because then it's, you know, passive euthanasia. This always comes up in medical ethics questions. And of course, the Roman executioner did it. And then he jumped into the fire himself and died. And that's the famous story, but it's a powerful story. And the heavenly voice came out and says, Yesh kone olamo b'shachat. Somebody can acquire the world in one moment. This Yimach Shmo, disgusting murderer, Roman executioner, is also going to Olam Haba. He's him and Rabbi Yudah and Rav Hanani ben Trajan are coming to Olam Haba, because a person can acquire the world. Oh no, they're coming to Olam Haba. Rabbi Yudah Hanasi, living two generations later, Rabbi Yudah Hanasi was the one who was crying, saying, Yesh Kone Olamo B'Shachat. It's not fair. Some people have to work their whole life to get to the world to come, and some people get it in one moment. Anyway, that's the famous story of Rabbi Hanani ben Trajan. Shnaim sheyoshvim bein beinayim divrei Torah. Two people who are sitting, and there's no Torah between them. Ein beinayim divrei Torah. We'll see that word's important. Harezim moshav leitzim. This is a joker. This is a bunch of jokers, a house of scoffers. Like the first, we're going to quote the first pasuk in Tehillim. Areza Shenemar Moshav Leitzim, Ashrei Ish, blessed is the person who sits in the house of God. Moshav Leitzim with the jokers. In other words, it's not sinful. You're not doing anything sinful, but it's a joke. Maybe it's worse. It's like Avashnaim Sheyoshvim VeYesh Beinayim Divrei Torah. But if two people are sitting, and between them there are the words of Torah, Shechina Beinayim, God joins them. Shenemar Az Nidbaru Yirei Hashem, then those who feared God spoke, Yirei Hashem, Isha Rayu, Vayikshav Hashem, God listens. This is a pasuk, the end of Malachi, if I have time, I'll come back to it. God listened and heard, Vichatev, and he wrote it down. Two people sitting learning, like God writes down for Rosh Hashanah, right? He writes Sefer HaZikaron, he writes the Book of Remembrance, Lefanav, Yirei Hashem, Ulechashvei Shmo, for those who fear God and then think about his name. So to learn Torah, two people, wow, it gets a permanent marker in the book. Now, I heard this originally from Rav Tabori, Binyamin Tabori, who was my Rosh Yeshiva when I went to Or Chaim, who were still in the year since he passed away when I was Rebbe in Yeshiva Har Etzion for many years. I heard it from him in the name of Chaim of Volozhin, but I just saw it last night in the Tosfot Yontif in the 16th century from Prague, Rav Yontif Lipman Heller, commentary on the Mishnah that explains, that's really powerful. There's no Torah between them. It doesn't, what the Mishnah is referring to is not, you can have two people who are learning Torah. That doesn't count. This one in this room, and this corner, that one in that corner. Ain't the Torah has to be between them. Ain't Torah b'neihem. When two people sit and learn, but b'neihem, between them, they each learns in his own, his own capsule, so to speak. That's a Moshe of Leitzim. What a joke. What do you think you are? You think you can learn on your own? Think you don't need an input from other people? We know the traditional way of learning is to learn with a study partner. You challenge each other, you criticize each other, you don't accept what they say, right? You yell at each other. That's why base measures is so noisy. So what the Mishnah is stressing is not the way we normally read it. Of course, two people are sitting and they're talking about the baseball game, whatever. They're not talking Torah at all. That's a joke if they talk Torah. But he's saying, no, if two people are sitting, this one's learning in this corner, and this one's learning this, but they don't talk to each other, that's a Moshe of Leitzim. In a sense, that's even worse. These are two people who understand, but there's no connection between the two people learning Torah. So that's what the Mishnah, Shnaim Sheishim Yesh Beinehem, in between in their words of Torah, God will listen and learn. And then the Mishnah concludes, Ein li'el l'shnayim, there are only two, minayin afilu achad. What if even one person sits alone and he learns Torah? He talks to himself. Shakadosh Baruch Hu koveya lo schar. So God doesn't write it down. That's, you need two people. You got to learn with somebody else to get it written down. Shenemar yashav badad vayidom kinaf alalav. He sits alone. This passage is from Echa, Yashva Badad. It's the third chapter of Perek Echa. A person is sitting alone, but at least he's learning Torah, so God listens and writes for him, or doesn't write for him, has a reward. Okay, it's 10:28, let me just quickly review what we learned, and I'll get to the one question I see here. We discussed Akavya ben Mahalal, why I love him so much, intellectual honesty, not changing his opinion to get power, even if you're in the minority, but if you worked out the opinion, you don't change just because other people did disagree with you. The whole question about bias and the converts and drinking of the soda water, and then what he told his kids, no nepotism, you got to earn it on your own, and even his kids shouldn't follow his own opinion, unless they worked it on his own. You follow your parents if you're part of their tradition or their many views, but if everybody says X and one oddball says Y, only if you learn with that oddball, I use that term endearing way, then you follow him, otherwise not. And then we discuss what he said, Akavya ben Mahalal, we come from nowhere, we're going to nothing, and we have to give an account for God. So this is someone who is full of fear of God. Nobody had great fear of God. It's not something to normally think about. That would drive us too crazy, and that's not good. But every once in a while, then to very true of reason, we see arrogance and lust and ideological reasons, a deen and cheshbon, what we're doing wrong and what we could do right when we're doing wrong, and the importance of praying for the government, even the government of the Tsar. I don't think anybody can think that the Israeli government is worse than the Tsar, you know, and gotta pray because anarchy is the worst to have, even and the importance of learning, but not just learning, of learning with other people, between them. That Torah is meant to be discussed and debated and argued. Okay, just so many. Okay, so thank you very much. Sunday morning, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering on Kriyat Shema, 11 a.m. Just let me quickly see. Did they pray for Lenin and Stalin? I don't know, but I assume yes. I assume they had no choice, but I don't really know. I know from the Tsar, I don't know what happened. Under communism, it was much harder. They tried to eradicate religion. But listen, even Soviet Russia, there was a certain, you know, sense of, as evil as they were, you could walk on the streets. You don't want to live somewhere where you can't walk on the streets, where there's rioting, there's no control, like they're... Whatever, I know it's a complex issue, and we find it hard, but Jews lived under horrific conditions for... Often we had under good conditions, but we're not praying for the person, even though they're had for the Tsar. We're really praying for the Shloma, the peace of the kingdom. There'd be peace. We're not saying, and how obviously we want to pray they should get better. Bochi for hours of time, Toda. Okay, that's it. Okay. I don't think somebody asked me about was we say prayer for the monarch in the UK, and when Charles divorced Diana, she was then omitted. They mentioned the names, right? Yeah, your son is our. We don't mention names. We don't mention names, but correct. You saw that they mentioned the name of the Tsar, and in England, so they mentioned what? Irene, they mentioned Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, Prince Charles, and now I don't think they've done Camilla.
Camilla, they mentioned Camilla, but so no, now they can't mention.
No, they just say the Prince and Princess of Wales. I think they've learned. I don't pray for Charles. I think he's anti-Semitic, but personally,
whatever.
No, okay. Well, I know quite a lot of what goes on here. I think Canadians are very positive about Britain, which is very nice. But anyway, I think William is very good. But I see your point. There was a rabbi who supported Hitler. You know, the head of the Hildesheim.
No, yeah, of course. Marsha Perron, his book has the three day age Hitler, Yimach Shemo, came to power. Listen, right. This too will pass. It'll be not good. Yeah. We can't judge people,
I agree.
If you're living through that, they just went through World War I. Nobody could envision what would happen. So, yes, some insightful people did. And correct. And when the Sri Deyesh, Mark Shapiro has in his book, I think he wrote a letter. What's it, the letter? You're a great guy. So letter, let's work together. You know, listen, yeah. Rivka Bauer spoke here on Wednesday. I don't know if some of you heard. So yes. She just alluded to it very briefly. You know, her father, yeah. Rabbi Teitz, who spoke so beautifully about, was known, she to be famous. He was against, or so they said, and she sort of denied it a little bit. He was against all the rallies for Soviet Jewry. You know, when I was a student at university, we'd go on Solidarity Sunday in front of the UN. Literally, there would be 300,000 people there. That was, and the vice president would come and speak, and the president would send a message, and the senator of New York, and Avital Sharansky would come, and, you know, etc. Yeah. And, you know, we would rally, and then they would put pressure at the Jackson-Bannock Amendment not to sell wheat to Russia, etc. And Rabbi Teitz was very much, he would travel, you heard, she went to Russia 23 times, and he would talk to the government, and he, this word was, he was against the rallies, that he thought this was hurting. They like when you protest against, you know, China, you see, I'm not saying you shouldn't protest, maybe they just say it's, but sometimes the protests make it worse. It's hard to know. That's where Rav Soloveitchik famously said, you have to ask the Soviologist, whatever the term is. You have to ask the political scientist. It's not a luck question. You have to ask what's more effective. What Dr. Blau said on Wednesday, the father wasn't so much against the rallies. He thought you needed a two-pronged approach. You needed people to negotiate with Brezhnev and because even when people are evil, sometimes the only way to get something, they act in their self-interest. And believe me, evil people have self-interest too. You know, I'm not commenting, I'm not making any political opinion, but I understand the view that we should talk to Iran. I understand that view. You can argue, yes, no, but sometimes the only way to get something done is through talking. So that's all.